It is Charlie Lim. You're listening to the Bold But Gold podcast.
Hello, everyone. It's Walter Wong here, welcoming you to another edition of the Bold But Gold podcast. Now, my guest on today's show is someone whom I've been wanting to speak to ever since I first listened to his music in 2015. He writes some wonderfully intricate music, and he even lent his talents to our National Day song in 2018. I'm talking, of course, about the one and only Charlie Lim. For many years now, Charlie has been one of the mainstays in the English pop music scene in Singapore. His first full-length album, Time and Space, was released in 2015 to critical acclaim, and if you haven't heard it yet, you absolutely should. And of course, you can do it in vinyl. Charlie has racked up quite the list of accolades in his music career. He has sold out multiple shows at the Esplanade, gotten signed by Universal Music, and yes, has done the almost impossible by actually making We Are Singapore sound contemporary in 2018. In that same year, he also released his second full-length album, Check Hook. But as you might expect from his music, Charlie has gone through some emotional lows as well. It all means that he's incredibly thoughtful about what success actually means, and he certainly kept me thinking long after our conversation was done. Now, we sat down quite fittingly at the Esplanade to talk it all through. Charlie was great company, and he even gave a mini songwriting masterclass near the end. But I just have a little word of warning before we start. The couches that we were sitting on seemed to be made of the most inflexible leather, so you will hear some shuffling along the way. It was also storming outside, so there might be some thunder in the distance. But there's nothing like cold weather and noisy seating implements to set the mood. I invite you to now join us, and I hope you enjoy our conversation. You released your second album last year, your second full-length album. Have you been touring to support it or something?
Yes and no. I think like tours are just ridiculously expensive, and you know, there's not a huge demand for Charlie Lim worldwide. We're not selling out stadiums.
Yeah.
So we're doing like little festivals here and there.
Yeah.
Yeah, little promo things. But not like back-to-back dates, you know. So we do like, we just played a show in Manila.
You played one over this weekend in Singapore as well.
Sorry?
You played one this weekend, right?
In we did the Sundown Festival thing.
By the way, how was, so that was like EDM, and then you're
hip-hop,
not quite, and
EDM, then,
but then you're not quite EDM or hip-hop.
Yeah, so it's weird, man.
How do you feel this space?
I don't know. I imagine it's hard for a programmer to like slot like me somewhere in, because it really depends on, we kind of do everything, and with the band, there are a lot more variables, but then when I play solo, it's just like acoustic, right? But the show itself was a little bit messy because the stages were going on at this like simultaneously, so the sound was just bleeding. But you know, we made the most of it, and I kind of jammed out to what was happening in the background, and people seemed to appreciate that. You just kind of don't care and you roll with the punches, and actually turns out pretty fun. So everyone had a good time, I think. I had a good time, so it is what it is.
Yeah.
It was what it was.
But you're okay, firstly, do I say it's check hook or do I say check and hook?
Check hook.
Check hook.
Yeah. A check hook is a boxing move.
Oh yes, now it makes more
Yes.
Inspired by boxing life.
Yeah. And if you didn't know that, I think it's quite a strange term, you know, like, so I usually have to explain it and which is basically where your opponent's charging at you.
Yeah. And it's the one where you're against the ropes or something.
Not necessarily against ropes, but like cornered, and then you have to throw a hook at an angle and kind of spin around your opponent in order to gain control. And it's a really hard move to do, but when done right, you know, it's pretty awesome. It's kind of like a matador in a bullfight. So I titled
the new album. For your life,
I suppose so. For my life, I guess. My love for boxing.
Yep. And homage love to boxing.
Yeah. And
do you watch the Bolterweight one this weekend? The one with Khan and
Yeah, I did.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a strange match because it ended with a low blow, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. But the Lomachenko one was very fun to watch. Yeah. That was a few days ago before this. Anyway, check hook. I suppose it's quite an apt metaphor for what, you know, just kind of encapsulate what I've been going through for the last few years, and I think musically as well, you know, it's an interesting kind of different angle.
It's a different sound. I mean,
yeah, it is.
Like if I listen to that first, and I went back to time, space, or time and space, which one do you?
Either works.
Okay, time slash space. I wouldn't think it's the same artist, apart from the fact that your voice is the same, of course. But like, it is a. Why did you change your sound so much?
I think I just wanted to challenge myself. You know, I knew I had to do something different. I just didn't know what. You know, and after time and space, you know, I was just really burnt out.
Yeah.
And just kind of finding my own groove again. Just kind of stuck in a rut, as you do. You know, after you were talking about, you know, how the highs are very high and the lows are true. So I was just kind of quite lost in life, having my own little existential crisis again.
Yeah. From the outside, that's amazing, by the way, because, like, I mean, I'll look from the outside, it's like you had so much success after Time and Space. It's like so well received.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what success means anymore these days, and yeah, it's hard to measure that sometimes, you know, and it's hard to define it. It's always a moving goalpost when you talk about success, and we can go into that more later if you want. But with this record, I think I just needed to feel free again and like remember why I make music in the first place. Yeah, and kind of take off some of that pressure from the last record and make something that would be refreshing to myself first and foremost. And yeah, it took a little bit less time than Time and Space did.
How long did that journey take?
Maybe about 2 years or so.
And did you write it primarily here or on the road, or I mean,
between here and Melbourne? Yeah, so I worked on this record with two of my friends who are based in Melbourne, with some help from the guys here in Singapore as well.
There's a lot of sampling in this one. Were you the one who said you wanted that sound, or was it just like when you guys were playing around the studio and then like, you know, it sounds good, and then you're like, you put it in?
A bit of both. Like a lot of the sampling per se was, actually no, there wasn't a lot of sampling. It was more just, we sampled ourselves.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of jamming, and then we would just like cut up stuff that, you know, we thought was funny.
Yeah.
Not even cool. It was just funny. Yeah. You know, could we use that for something?
Because
know?
Like, okay, so for example, in Welcome Home, right? Yeah. It starts with a loop of a sample of something.
Yeah.
Do you remember what that was? Because I cannot recognize it in the song at all. Like, it doesn't sound like a sample of the chorus.
Oh, no, that's not. So we were just, that itself was just a guy singing in the car.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, and so then, I just like snipped a bit of it and then like pitched it up, and yeah, I just ripped it off YouTube.
So it, so it wasn't even like one of you, it was like...
So that one wasn't, but everything else was. Like, yeah, just finding really weird things that are probably illegal if I told you like what the actual sample was now. But they're so warped and pitched that you wouldn't be able to find the original thing. Yeah. And I think I like making musical ideas out of things that weren't musical to begin with. Yeah. Which is quite, I don't know, it's like a bit more contrary to a lot of hip-hop sampling, which is like, you know, they take a very specific musical phrase, right, and then they build from that. Sometimes I mean, for this record, I think we kind of did the opposite. Like, I played a lot of the tracks, I played a lot of the harmonic content first and built the tracks. And then we got other random sounds and throw it in just
I thought you actually did the beats first because of how... It was, well, not all the tracks, it is, but quite a lot of them are very
beat-heavy. Well, it depends how you define beat. Like, if it's just the rhythm, then no, not so much. I think it's, I would kind of come up with a chord progression. And, you know, my producer friend, either you or Simon, you know, kind of will just muck around and find a sound, and then we just build something from there.
Mm-hmm.
They would, however, handle the rhythm section aspect. So it was like, you know, were a band and they were playing the drums and bass and I would play the melodic parts and harmonic parts. And I'll also play the bass as well. Yeah. But yeah, it was a lot more collaborative than my last record. Yeah.
So your last record was mainly you writing in a bedroom or something?
Yes. Okay. I mean, this album, to be honest, was mostly like in our rooms as well. Yeah, you know? So it's all kind of very DIY.
Yeah.
The fun part was just making shitty things sound good.
It's quite
interesting. Hi-fi, lo-fi, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
we did sample quite a lot of weird stuff that ended up on the record, and you know, you wouldn't recognize what the original sample was.
Yeah. For the first album, right? So you say it took longer. So was it something that you had been writing for like years, just on and off, and then you were like, I'm gonna put it into an album, or did you deliberately say I'm gonna make an album, and then I took like 3 years or something to write it?
I think everyone probably has the intention to have a body of work, right?
Yeah.
Whether it's an album or an EP. But the idea for Time and Space only came about, like, I guess halfway through writing some of these demos mm-hmm. and tunes, and mm-hmm. it kind of clicked in my head, and like, okay, to have these two separate halves, one yeah. slightly more acoustic, one more electronic.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of, a lot of it's probably post-rationalized. Yeah. I think conceptualize, like pre-conceptualization, I don't know, I don't buy it.
Mm-hmm.
And just from experience and also seeing a lot of work that artists have done, like anything that's probably thought out too much at the start yeah. or like stuff with too much intent
yeah.
and people talking too much about what they mean.
But yes.
Yeah, it doesn't have that same effect. Yeah. I think if you have to talk so much about why something is good or the reason as to why this makes you feel a certain way,
yeah.
then it kind of defeats the purpose, I think.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm the opposite. I'm like, if something, if a piece of music, for example, yeah. makes me feel engaged or happy or sad or something,
yeah.
I would actually want to try to overanalyze and overintellectualize why. No,
that's fine. That's fine. I yeah. mean, like, what I'm trying to say is like, if I were to, before I played you the song,
mm-hmm.
but I explain everything as to how you should feel.
Yeah, you tell and don't show, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what I mean, right? Yeah. Like, it's just so much concept and gimmicks yeah. and talking about the concepts,
yeah.
but then when I actually play the thing, do you feel the way that you,
yeah.
you know, like, if I have to do that, then maybe it defeats the purpose, right? I think yeah. reverse engineering is okay, like you know, backtracking, understand, trying to understand why you feel a certain mm-hmm. way from a piece of art, that's fine, and that's yeah. what everyone should do, right?
Yeah.
But from a creator's point of view, I think if they talk so much about why yeah. you think something is good, then
yeah.
maybe it doesn't.
Yeah, but when you have to like, tell someone, like, this is how you should feel and this is why yeah. you should feel it.
Which, you know, it's, I guess this is a bit of a criticism of yeah. a lot of postmodern art. You read the long descriptions of
yeah.
how art is supposed to make you feel, but then you look at it and you're like, nope, I don't get this. Sometimes you just know that this is just fluff, right?
Yeah.
Like, or even worse, because, like, you've also exposed your what you intended and how... you've fallen short of making someone
yeah,
feel.
Yeah.
Anyway, this is a whole different conversation.
Yeah, no, but I know what you mean. Like, you go to an art gallery now and it's like a blank canvas and you're like, oh, but then the essay on the side is as long as the...
Yeah, it's amazing.
The canvas itself.
It's amazing. Yeah, the times I've been to the... Yeah, I've been to the Tate.
The Tate Modern or the Tate?
Tate Modern.
Okay.
A couple of times. It's like,
yeah.
it's pretty
Tate
funny.
Tate Modern is, yeah.
it's pretty funny. Anyway, yes.
Anyway, but so in between the first and second album, you signed for Universal, right?
Yeah, I signed with the Universal Music Singapore yeah. label.
Big moment, happy, sad, not happy.
Man, I don't know, if it feels like a lifetime ago now since I don't know, I don't think it was like, oh, I've made it.
Or yeah.
I don't think it was like a... When you're like 16 or 17,
yeah.
and like the idea of like, a record label sounds really enticing, right? I suppose as you get older and you know, more experience in the industry, and there are more variables at play, you realize like what it takes to be successful. You're trying to understand what it. Let me try to rephrase this. It's very hard to define success
mm-hmm.
when you're first starting out, right? And you just kind of go blindly for something, whether that's like, I don't know, a Grammy award,
yeah,
right, just what every kid
or a compass award
dreams. Well, I wouldn't say that, but you know, I mean, it's what you see on the TV, right? Yeah. Your heroes are performing on TV. It's like, yeah, let's dream big, you know, let's go all out for Grammy awards, let's get a record deal like these guys, because these are like, they become tropes of success, mm-hmm. and you have that in your mind. Yeah, but I think when you actually get to that point when you're dealing with all those decisions and you realize that there are way more variables at play, you realize like, I'm not saying it's not a big deal, right? Like it's, you know, it's something that I'm proud of, but at the same time, like there's a lot of weight and baggage involved
mm-hmm,
in,
mm-hmm.
I guess, these measures of success.
Were you worried that you were going to have to compromise on any sort of principles in any way, or...
Not really, because of what I heard about the label, and the good thing so far is that they've given me free rein to do whatever I want. To be honest, like, part of it feels like an indie label because they're very understaffed. At least the Singapore side of things.
Oh man, okay.
So they just kind of, they try their best to execute whatever I'm doing, but there are certain things that are definitely not aligned, just because of the way the company is structured. But in terms of what I've been able to get away with, like, it's just, it's been pretty good. Whether it's been marketed well or not, that's another question. But in terms of, like, creative control and all that, nah, they wouldn't know where to start, right? So they're just like, no, let's, you just focus on what you would do and we'll try our best to support it. So that I've been quite grateful for. Yeah, and having the resources to do that has been great. Not having to worry how to raise capital to record and release, you know, the album has been a weight off my shoulders. At the same time, it has its, you know, own baggage as well. You know, having a big machine also means there are more parts to oil. A lot of things to put in place. There's a lot of administration that doesn't...
You probably don't enjoy that so much.
Yeah. Not, I mean, I like administration because, like, it's a, you know, it's a checklist, you can get stuff done, but it's dealing with, like, a whole team of people and people you don't even see or even know. It gets tricky to get something as simple as changing, like, a lyric that's misspelt or a title that's misspelt. Yeah, I guess when you have people who are dedicated jobs to just do one thing, and they're so far removed from, you know, this entire chain. I mean, it's a giant chain of command that goes down. It's so far removed from the artist. It gets a bit hard sometimes, you know, to get simple things done. I miss the immediacy of being independent. And sometimes you just wonder, like, in this day and age, like, this shouldn't be an excuse to get shit done, like, faster. And things would be so much easier if you just gave me the autonomy to do stuff on my own, you know. So yeah, they're good and bad.
Yeah, but you talked about the capital. So I guess what I'm curious about is, when you were recording Time and Space, how did you find the capital? Because that one was yourself, and you also actually literally cut physical albums, which in, you know, the mid 2010s is not popular to do anymore.
Yeah, yeah. Just savings, a lot of it.
Yeah.
We had some support from NAC, a lot of support from the studio that I was recording in. But yeah, just savings, you know. So it was really a labor of love and, you know, a combination of, like, naivety and stupidity and poor financial planning. I don't know. just a lot of passion, I suppose. You know.
Did you actually sell a lot of copies of the physical CD?
Yeah, surprisingly. I think we were just, like, at the tail end of that window.
Yeah, it was just about right, like, 2014, right? So
Yeah. Like, the first EP, we also sold, like, most of it, which is good. Yeah, before Time and Space, I released an EP.
Yeah.
That was kind of what got the ball rolling.
Yeah.
Yeah, but Time and Space, you know, I can't remember how many we printed. Mm-hmm. Not, like, you know, hundreds of thousands, but at least a thousand plus. And, you know, we managed to sell most of the CDs.
Yeah.
Then Universal came on board and they did the vinyl for it. So that did quite okay as well.
How did you feel about the... Because Time and Space was incredibly well received. I'm not sure commercially, but...
Well, relatively to, I'd say, for, like, the local market, I guess it's okay.
Yeah.
In context of this day and age where everything's digital, it was kind of stuck between the iTunes era and even before streaming became mainstream. Yeah,
because I think Spotify might not have been in Singapore yet at the moment you released. I'm not so sure when that happened.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it wasn't huge back then. Yeah.
So how did you feel about the response? So, like, definitely critically, it was very well received, and, like, it was your label of love for, like, 3 years or whatever. How did you feel about it all?
Vindicated is too strong a word, but
somewhat.
Yeah, I poured a lot into it, and it was just so tiring to think about, even, like, talking about it now. But I'm glad I went through that process. I'll never go through it again. I don't ever want to hit those low points, you know, in life, just trying to figure that stuff out. It becomes a terrible feedback loop, you know, when you end up writing about writing. You're struggling a lot to come up with something that you're just can be proud of and able to put out there.
Yeah.
But to be honest, I don't know if I would have released the album if there wasn't that show at the Esplanade Concert Hall.
Yeah.
You know, so we...
That's when you did it with the Great Spikes.
Yeah, and then Inch. That was in 2015 under the House of Riot, which was my old management label.
Mm-hmm.
So I think being a perfectionist and always like trying to get, you know, trying to maximize everything, and you always think that you can do better. When there's no time limit, you just never
get it done.
Yeah. So I mean, I listen back and there are things I wish I could change still, but.
So I wanted to ask that actually, because whenever I go for your shows and whenever I'm in Singapore and you perform, you reinvent most of your tracks, you rearrange it. Even if it's acoustic, you do it differently from a previous one.
Right.
Do you actually even see Time and Space or Check Hook as being done, or do you see it as like, I need to go back and always rework it and change it and then like create a new sound from it?
Well, I see the record as a... It's its own thing for sure.
Yeah.
That's kind of solidified, and then, you know, the paint has dried for stuff that's on record, because it's a very different experience listening to, you know, recorded work. You know, the way you treat it is very different from how you would perform it live as well. And to translate stuff that is recorded into a live performance, it's a different ballgame itself. Wouldn't have the same effect even if you played the same parts, right?
Yeah.
Because there are other variables involved. Like how you would mix it, and even the venue and the number of people.
So basically, the canvas has changed.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. In terms of the album versions per se. Yeah, I guess that's done. You know, if you ask me if I wish I could go back and change a few things, I would definitely. Yeah. You know, but unfortunately, just have to move
money
on.
Money and time.
Something else.
Yes.
Money and time.
Yeah. It's just a consideration to most of life.
That's what the album should have been called. Not
money
time and space.
time and money.
Yeah.
That's the re-release of Time and Space in 5 years.
Yeah. What it should have been. It's like all the high def versions, remastered audio file versions.
Like the Beatles release.
Yeah, exactly.
So, okay, let's go even further back. So what I'm curious about as well is, did you go through the sort of Singapore music machine when you were a kid? Like, you know, ABRSM, piano, violin, I don't know, like, what else?
No, I just did piano. Yeah.
Until which grade, I suppose?
I think it was like 7 or something.
Do you like it?
Man, I didn't love like the classical thing.
Yeah.
But I could get away with it.
Yeah.
With minimal practice. So it was like the easy way out for me.
So you were good at sight reading?
No, I wasn't.
Oh,
I was terrible. Yeah. I still am terrible. But I would like improvise my sight reading and get away with it.
So you would hear it?
No. I would like read a like maybe one line on top, and then just like play random crap.
Are you serious? Okay.
And like maybe the examiner didn't know the piece, but they were like, "Oh,
okay. This sounds involved."
Yeah, this sounds legit. Okay. And he's keeping time, so
yeah.
I don't know. So I got away with. Like music was like the path of least resistance for me, and also like the easy way out for me, like growing up, you know, and doing music as a subject in school. When I moved to Melbourne, like, you know, I got good marks for it.
Yeah.
So I was being rewarded for
being
lazy, pretty much, and just kind of pursuing what I enjoyed. Yeah. So I was, I still am quite an ill-disciplined person.
Yeah.
I chose it because I could get away with shit, right? Obviously, you know, the consequences of that I still face to this day. but to answer your question, I did go through a lot of the rigors of the kind of classical piano thing, but I managed to get away with it. I think what kept me I was still very attached to the piano, even though I didn't like the classical syllabus. Mm-hmm. Was church, actually. So I got to improvise, play with a band. There was just this one teacher as well who, you know, besides the usual like exam curriculum, he also taught me how to play, like, you know, basic chords and how to play by ear as well. Yeah. He didn't teach me how to play by ear, but like he would teach
encourage
me how to,
you to do it, I suppose.
I would learn a melody, but he would teach me how to harmonize, you know, just basic diatonic harmony and. That I really enjoyed. And then I would listen to stuff on radio or CD and try to learn pop songs and just attach chords to them.
Yeah. did studying at a university lessen your love for music in any way? Because as much as it's easy for you, still like grades go up and down, and that might affect, you know.
So I went to, I'll give you a quick background. After Sec 2, I left for Melbourne to study my A-level equivalent. So I did music as a subject in there. Somehow managed to top the state for music performance.
Mm-hmm. Victoria?
State of Victoria. Yeah. And obviously you have a lot of delusions of grandeur from there. And then, oh yeah, I can definitely do music as a living.
Yeah.
Obviously that bubble has popped.
Has
burst many times.
Because you're actually doing it, so it hasn't actually...
Well, I mean, the idea of it, what that entails as well. Yeah. Oh yeah, I'm gonna be a rock star for sure. Yeah, you know, came back to do NS at the music and drama company. Mm-hmm. So I learned the ropes, I guess, of not just being a performer, but you know, have to be your own roadie, moonlighted with a producer who is actually the music director for National Day. Dr. Sidney Tan, and I learned a lot. And
who was a real doctor, like a
actual doctor. Pretty ridiculous. I can go on for hours, but like the guy, he's just been a great mentor. But when I first like started, I knew nothing, you know, with music production, and he kind of just threw me my first Mac, and I had to learn Logic, and it was terrifying. Yeah. And that was when I was like, oh, I know nothing. I know absolutely nothing, and I was just thinking to myself, if this is what it takes to be a successful musician, then I definitely have a long way to go. So after NS, I went back to Melbourne to study like a double degree in music and arts thing. In the end, ended up dropping the arts thing. I just wanted to finish uni and get out as quick as possible. But by my third, fourth year, I was hardly in class. You know, I was just trying to do my own thing. I was recording my own EP and already playing shows and doing a little bit of touring as a sideman as well.
But in
Australia, and after I graduated, I came back to Singapore. But you know, your question about whether that made, as in, did it deter me or my love for music?
Yeah.
I think if I went back now, I probably would have enjoyed it a lot more. But back then, I was just so eager and just so I couldn't sit still. I just needed to make music instead of learning, you know, about history and all that.
So you wanted to actually produce. Well, it's like less musicology and more of the actual, let's do it, let's write.
I suppose But like I said, you know, if I was given the opportunity to study again now, I think I could learn a lot more, and then that would inform my music making. But there was no way in hell at that time I would have done that, because I was just so eager to get stuff out. I was so in love with the stuff that I was listening to. I just had to make something that.
So what were you listening to at the point? Do you remember?
A lot of like, I wouldn't say alternative music now, because I suppose it's slightly left of center, you know. Back then, at uni, I was in love with like D'Angelo, a lot of new, kind of late 90s, early 2000s, neo soul, Jay Dilla, Erykah Badu, the whole Soulquarian thing. I've always loved contemporary like singer-songwriters, so Jeff Buckley has been a huge influence, John Mayer, can't escape the guy, obviously, Damien Rice, Ray LaMontagne, Rachel Yamagata.
Oh, Rachel Yamagata, she was Singapore a few years back, I think.
Yeah, so I'd say like contemporary singer-songwriters, you know, and these guys, yeah, they kind of opened my eyes to a lot of the older, I guess you could call staples, I suppose, Joni Mitchell, Bob Dylan, Nina Simone. I listened to a lot of Radiohead, I suppose, around that time.
What I find super interesting about what you just said is, you know how like people usually, I guess now like boxing is how you get away from music, but like the way you got away from music in school was to do more music on the side.
Right.
That is incredible. Like.
It's weird because now I have to escape that itself, because it's become the job.
And you're going back to school to study it, so actually your life is moving in a cycle.
It's pretty funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess we're always just like, music is always like, there's a level of escapism about it, right? Yeah. And that expression in itself, you know, of passion or enjoyment or trying to find some meaning in, you know, in spite of the mundane. Yeah, that's what kind of makes you feel alive. But then when it becomes your day job, then...
yeah, you're like, oh, it's
fine. Yeah.
But when you told your parents, I guess, that you were going to study music and also that you were starting to record and produce stuff, like, what was the reaction that you got? Like, Charles, don't do this.
Yeah, when I first dropped all my sciences,
yeah,
it was a bit of a shock to them. But yeah, like I said, there was just no way of stopping that kid, yeah. You know?
Yeah.
I was just so adamant on doing this, and yeah. just a very emotional and stubborn kid. Yeah. There was no way I could have changed my mind.
Yeah.
I was just doing everything that I loved, and I was just like, nope, there's no plan B.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just gonna go ahead with this. Yeah, but if I were in my parents' shoes, I'd definitely be concerned.
Would you tell, I don't know, 12 years ago Charles to do the same or not?
I probably wouldn't have studied music, to be honest.
Really?
Yeah, okay. I think.
What would you study?
Well, you know how I did like that arts and
yeah
arts degree as well yeah. as the music. Like I was studying a bit of theology and philosophy, yeah. and I think that I wish I pursued that a little bit more. Okay. You know, I think that would have been a little bit more like enriching, I suppose. You know. Mm. Like I don't read as much these days, but you know, back then I think lit would be, you know, studying more literature would probably be more helpful and informative as a, you know, being a writer. I would probably have encouraged myself to try something different.
Do you now see music as a passion or a profession?
Mm. Well, I guess by default, you know, you're doing business from it and you're surviving off it. It is a profession,
yeah.
But I'm trying to find ways to escape that as well. And ironically, I need it to be a passion in order to make stuff that I like. Right? So I have to kind of trick myself into thinking that it is still a passion.
Yeah. Otherwise, your creative juices will.
I think
the songs will be like Nicki Minaj and Young Money and all that stuff.
Well, you know, I still think some of their stuff is quite good.
Yeah.
It's quite interesting, but I don't think there is a very there's craft in everything, even in how you go about navigating the music business. I don't see it as a binary thing when something is art or commerce. I think compromises, you know, have to be made regardless. Yeah. And even if you were in this completely abstract world of art, you need to make compromises within that domain, right? Because no matter what, it involves an audience. Unless you're just making art for yourself, then... But yeah, that's the... I guess the paradox of it, and sometimes we are a bit too, you know, we're very precious about this idea and we romanticize, you know, how like pure art should be.
Like high art and mass art and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I don't think it's that clear cut. Yeah. I don't think it's that clear cut. At the end of the day, only you will know your own intentions, right? And if you are
snobbish, I suppose.
Yeah. I think we've strayed from the point, but...
No. This is directly relevant to the point.
What were we talking about again? I can't even remember.
About whether you see it as a passion or profession.
Yeah.
But it makes a lot of sense, like, what you were saying.
I think
as the line might not be so clear.
Yeah, it's not, because I'm still able to do what, you know, I love and make money from it, so yeah, that is a profession, I suppose. But to sustain that and, you know... To assume that it's sustainable, right? That's a tricky thing as well, because then that's where the business aspect comes in. And then the question is whether it's worth it, you know, and what are the compromises you need to make, or the decisions you have to make, or even not making a decision is a decision, right? And I often question myself, like, what do I need to do to achieve this next level of success? But then you have to define what that next step is. So is it being an expansionist? Like, are you trying to reach more people? Mm-hmm. Or are you just like focusing on what you do and try to make the best out of it and hope that you pick up some new fans along the way and your current fan base will follow you,
and will accept the change in sound and stuff
like that? So even for this new record, which is quite a departure from Time and Space, like it's quite a huge risk. I don't even know if it was a calculated risk, because there was
so you weren't planning to like try to reach a big audience, and so you're like, oh, you know.
No, if anything, I think there was a bigger risk in doing so, because it would have alienated a lot of people that I guess liked me for that sound, right? In the previous record. But thankfully, you know, I haven't been completely abandoned.
It's good.
So it's definitely a risk, you know. I'm not sure how calculated it was, but I knew I just needed to make something different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I guess before we come back into the present, one more thing about when you move to Australia. I'm always quite fascinated by people who actually spend quite a lot of the formative years in a different culture, different country. So I guess the two parts of this thing. First is, what was it like moving there at 14? You have a lot of friends here already, and then suddenly you're going there. That's one thing. The second thing is, like, was music a way of dealing with the change in environment, either in bad or good ways, but like dealing with the change of scene suddenly?
Yeah, for sure. You know, we were talking about escapism before, right? I think music definitely made me feel safe. It's always been that emotional kind of crutch for me. You know, I just kind of hold myself up in the practice room and just kind of jam out by myself. So I was very happy doing that. I was quite extroverted as a kid in Singapore, and then I became a huge introvert in...
When you were in Melbourne?
Yeah, but even I don't know, secondary school days also, like, I just kind of
started to...
really kind of felt a bit like a fish out of water, and even more so when I moved to Melbourne. But the practice room was my safe space, and that's where I learned, picked up the guitar then, and it definitely was helped me to cope a lot with the changes around me.
Yeah. Do you miss your youth in Australia?
I miss having time to just do anything I want, and just waste it. Without feeling too guilty.
Yeah. Well, let's move back into the present day, I suppose. Take the time machine back. I'm curious to know as well, like, because I think everyone who is in the creative industry is very different, like, into the creative process, right? Like, some people are like, I'm going to be disciplined about it, write, half a song every day or something like that. Others are more like, I need time away. Like, are you more of the sort of, you need to move away for a while, experience something new, and then slowly you accumulate your experiences in art?
Based on, like, my own experience, I'm not the kind of writer that can just, like, sit down and, like, crap out a song or just regurgitate, like... I can't write when I'm depressed, I think. Can't write when I'm emotionally exhausted. I think I have ideas, when I'm triggered or when something happens, but, like, to form a full song, to kind of stitch it all together with an arrangement in mind, that's quite rare. It's happened a couple of times. Well, it's happened, more than a couple of times, but the only successful songs that kind of made the cut, just maybe a couple. Yeah, so it's terrifying because there's no real process to it. You can only show up and kind of make sense of what you already have, what's kind of floating around the subconscious, I suppose. You're just fishing. But 9 times out of 10, you don't come back with anything great.
It's quite interesting because, when I was speaking to Ben yesterday, or whenever this thing gets released, I'm assuming it's 2 weeks or something, he was saying... I think they worked with, like, the Swedish producers who are, like, machines. And he was telling me how the process of the Swedes, like, they will absolutely write in a day and make it, like, a job. Like, like a day job. You write it. And it's different from sort of finding it,
I've been put in those situations a couple of times. Yeah. But, like, it's a terrible feeling.
Scary, man.
Well, it's not... Okay, there is that pressure, to get it done. But, like, I just feel like I haven't done... It couldn't... Like, the product that I've put out, it's not the best it could have been. Personally, I'd much rather take my time. I don't know. I see the benefit in just, like, in just putting out quantity, and it just kind of definitely, like, lubricates, you get rust, I think, if you don't write for a long time, know? So if you keep at it, even if it's bad or not the best it could have been, you're probably better off that way, because... out of 100 tunes, one of them probably going to be pretty damn good. But I definitely come from the other side of the spectrum where, like, I polish the turd until it's...
That's one way of putting it.
Yeah. which is terrible as well, but because of that, I make very... I don't know. Everything is... I'm just so emotionally attached to everything I do, I think. So because of that, it's just... it's a very tiring process.
Yeah. Do you try to control everything, or are you able to let go of it for a while and let your producer go, or let your two friends, I guess, in Melbourne, to go fix it and then send you something back?
Yeah, I'm quite a control freak, I think.
Okay.
But I am slowly learning to let go. I know when someone's a lot better at something than I am, and I'll let him or her go ahead and deal with it, but only to a certain extent, because at the end of the day, like, I still like to have control of the structure of the song, and obviously I write the lyric and the melody, so that dictates a lot of how the song flows, right? But in terms of, like, mixing and more the technical aspects of you know, sound engineering, I would leave it to the engineer.
Streaming has changed the way the business works, right? Have you had to change the way you construct your songs, duration, structure, based on the streaming economy?
To put very simply, no, I don't think I have. Probably to my own detriment. Like, we also just dropped the album in less than 2 months. Probably out of necessity because we had a show in December. So we had to work backwards and we could only release the first song in August. In terms of individual songs, no. I really don't think we had that in consideration.
It's just quite interesting because it's like Mark Ronson, for example, right, has talked about how he actually does change the way he writes to suit streaming, which I find amazing because, like, the medium is, I guess when you think of songwriters, you don't think of them actually composing it for a medium, streaming, a CD or something, but, like, some of them do, and I find it just fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah,
I guess I'm just a bit more traditionalist.
Yeah.
To be fair, I think the songs on the new album are way shorter than Time and Space. Also because of the nature of the tunes, they're kind of poppier, I suppose. Yeah. So the structures and the forms are a bit more straightforward. So but to me, that is already kind of a little bit more concise.
And just casting my mind back to what you said earlier about Dr. Sidney Tanner doing the National Day thing with him. This guy's amazing, firstly. So what was it like working with him? Did he call most of the shots? Did you control most of it? Like, how was that?
For the song?
Yeah.
I think he called a bunch of us up, different writers, to just come up with, like, a 16-bar prelude to the NDP tune, which is 1987, We Are Singapore tune. Yeah, so I just did a demo for it. And then he just picked up my one.
Oh, so it was like yours was selected out of a buffet.
Not really a buffet, like. It wasn't so much an open call. I think he picked out a few writers that he liked, gave us a shot at it. So I just kind of mulled over it for a couple of weeks and then spent a night working on the demo. And in terms of the recording, the production, like what you hear on the final track, that's actually... Well, most of it is the demo.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and
wow, so even the vocals. Demo.
Well, to be fair, it was mixed well, mixed into the medley, into the original track. But like the vocals and everything, that was just all in my room. But in terms of the production for the rest of the tune, it was co-produced, I suppose. Yeah. At the end of the day, it's still, he would call all the final shots, so. Myself and Evan Lowe, also known as Adventure Time.
Yeah, Adventure Time. Right?
Yeah. Yeah, we just threw a lot of paint at the wall and whatever stuck was decided by him.
So he co-wrote it or co-produced it? Or?
Yeah, he also helped with the production. But Dr. Sid would make the final calls.
Yeah, he's an amazing guy, but a medical doctor or something. And
He just doesn't sleep. He's superhuman. He's doing it again this year.
This year, yeah.
It never ends.
Yeah.
It's insane.
What was amazing about your track is, like, the lyrics were not typical, at least in the prelude. I mean, of course, the main track is as it is, but, like...
Well, I wrote the thing, I'm just like, I'm not going to change this, so you guys can take it or leave it. I wasn't even sure if I was going to sing it, to be honest. But in the end... It got approved. I think there were, several layers of committee to go through. But being who he is, I think he fought for it. And from my understanding, there was a lot of apprehension at the start because, the lyrics are definitely not, propagandist. Not inherently optimistic when you open with a line like that, right? So it worked out because it was also it was a risk. But I think it resonated with, a certain zeitgeist, I suppose. Yeah. I don't know, with the current situation.
Of the moment, And that's what, to me, I mean, not like panning the previous year's ones, but that's what, to me, stood out about it, in that, like, it wasn't just like, oh, you know, beautiful rainbow and, you know, all mm-hmm. that stuff. There was a certain hint of, like, reality behind it.
Yeah. Well, actually, it is inherently optimistic because it's about taking ownership, right, at the yeah. end of the day. But the line starts off stating that things yeah. are uncertain and let's not pretend that yeah. they're not. You know, so I think that was why, you know, they were freaking out a little bit. Yeah. But, yeah, like, this is just, I don't know, it's yeah. kind of silly to think about it now.
The one technical thing, and I know in the email that we were trading, you said this wasn't the case, but I'm gonna ask it anyway. So the one technical thing which I thought was, so the song is in, I think, the key of C. I think the tonic is C, right?
No, I don't think so.
Is it not in C? Okay.
I can't even remember what key it's in, but it's clear. Okay. I don't think it's C.
But I thought you wrote the intro basically in the minor of the song. And that's why I said I think there might have been a modal interchange there, because I thought it was like the minor key was the confessional quiet stuff at the start, and then it moved into this very bombastic, typical We Are Singapore flag waving major key song.
Yeah,
but it might not have been what you did, I suppose.
No,
that's what I heard.
No, I yeah. just disguised it well. But no, it didn't start in a minor key for sure. Yeah, I think it's a yeah, it's E flat major all okay. the way through.
So even in your intro, it's E flat major as well.
Yeah, the chord shape. Yeah, I think maybe why it might have given that impression is just yeah. it's just because the chord isn't as outlined so much.
Yeah,
it could have gone yeah. either way, but no, it's definitely not in the minor key. Yeah.
Well, my ears are definitely not as good as yours. That's why I stopped the grade 6 and not grade 7.
No, nothing to do with that. But It's just a bit more ambiguous. The colors in the chords that I used didn't
wait,
have...
actually, so if you don't mind, I know this is a bit like technical, but like sure. explain how you put ambiguity in the chords, if that's okay.
I'm really bad with technicalities here, but
like lay my toes, I guess.
Just in the way you voice them, I suppose. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I would, you know, instead of playing like a straight up triad, yeah. you know, you can just drop the voicings. I don't think I played the third.
So you left that out.
Yeah, and you just don't like go to the five yeah. too much. Don't go to the, you know, the typical tropes lah. I'm just trying to remember what I was yeah. playing. Yeah, I don't know. It's definitely in a major key. Right? It's just that the voicing is a little bit more sparse. Yeah. Probably don't spell out the chord a bit yeah. too much. Like you don't have to play 1-3-5.
Yeah.
Maybe the extension might have, you know, because it's which makes it the major 7.
Yeah.
And then the bass is quite static.
So I find this compelling because like this must have come quite instinctively to you, right, when you wrote it. But then actually there's a whole wealth of like technical details behind it. But it's so natural.
Well, this is what I mean by like, yeah. you know, conceptualizing. Yeah. I didn't go in thinking, oh, I want to have this feeling or whatever, yeah.
but it came.
I don't want to manufacture this, you know, to try and fit the brief or anything. Yeah. I think it all just kind of came together quite intuitively. Yeah. Trying to understand why I did, you know, just in terms of, it's just maybe a taste thing.
Yeah.
Like I wouldn't have spelled yeah. the chord out, you know, in a straightforward major
yeah.
triad, where just because I don't like that sound and didn't yeah. complement what I was trying to say, but definitely not a minor key.
Yeah.
It's definitely E-flat.
Well, again, yeah. I did not major in music at university.
No worries. No worries.
Music degree. The last like 5 minutes is so instructive to me for how you work basically, because it's a feeling.
Yeah, it's just stabs in the dark. Yeah. Really. I think you can like pick up technique along the way, yeah. and you know you can try and emulate things that you yeah. like. Yeah, but I think when I'm writing anyway, a lot yeah. of it has to yeah. come from an intuitive place. Yeah. yeah.
Okay. Well, just two more things, I guess.
Sure, sure.
First thing is, what's next? So, we've got one EP, two albums out now. Like, is there a new album coming soon? Like, are you writing? Is this the start of the next 2 year phase?
I don't know. I guess so. Yeah. But I don't know. I don't know if I'm just like romanticizing or like romanticizing the album cycle, yeah. or I don't know. Like you were talking about the whole Spotify streaming thing,
yeah.
and maybe that has changed my perception in terms of how we should release music. Yeah. I'm entertaining the thought of just like going song by song now. Yeah,
like what Rihanna does, basically.
Yeah. So maybe that's a possibility. You know, I'm happy to like collaborate more this year. I've already done a couple already. Just hopping on different producers and songwriters and working with them, hopping on their tracks.
Yeah.
Yeah, I am working on new stuff, but it's probably going to take a while before I decide what to do with it.
Yeah. So you look back on your whole, on your, I guess the journey started when you were, even before university, but from university, doing it as a education, and then it has become your career, right? Would you do the same?
What do you mean the same?
Like, would you do like a doctor Sydney Tan, for example, have like a day job and then do this as a side hustle, or would you still keep it as your main career?
I don't know. It's such a strange, yeah. Like, it's a good hypothetical and something that I do think a lot, but yeah.
Because I'm coming back to the point of earlier you said, what is success?
Yeah,
and exactly. I'm trying to figure out, yeah, like, what is success?
It's a tough question, man. I guess a variant of this is also like asking, like, if a kid was asking me for advice, like, oh, you know, I really love music, and yeah, I have dreams of performing and doing what you do one day, and this has happened to me a few times, and they're like asking me for advice. I feel like the guy that has gone to war kind of come back and like, I mean, like, you know, I wouldn't trade this experience for the world, but would I do it again? I don't know. I'd probably live a different life just for the sake of having like new experiences, if you gave me that time machine option, right? But at the same time, like, you know, my experience has been very rewarding. The highs have been great, you know, and to actually see, you know, that I could make like a tangible difference in people's lives with what I do, I think that's very fulfilling. When something is more than just yourself, or like what starts out as something that inherently, you know, just quite selfish or self-expression, actually, you know, becoming relatable and having the ability to help others, and then you also work with people that you deeply respect and enjoy working with. I think those are I wouldn't trade that for anything. Yeah. If you're asking whether I do things a little bit differently, maybe, you know, I'm sure there are a lot of blind spots that I wish I knew about when I was younger. But at the same time, it's like, if you don't make those mistakes, you don't realize. So, I don't know. The truth is, like, everything is so uncertain. Oh, man, I'm just paraphrasing.
You just wrote a new National Day song.
Just quoting myself. Oh, dear. But, yeah, it's true. Like, I think, like, being okay with that is probably the first step to, you know, getting some of that confidence back. You need to roll with the punches and go with the flow.
And I guess someone last thing, so from what I'm hearing from that, it seems like what you're saying is the success is not, I mean, she talked about like Grammy Awards and all that stuff when you were a child, but actually what you see as success now seems to be the intangible stuff, right? Like impacting other people, working with people that you like, the joy of the process, I suppose.
Yeah, I think sustainability is very important. Otherwise it never ends, you know. I think the goalposts always shift. You'll never be happy. I think like one thing I've learned is that I think a lot of this romanticization can be dangerous, because you always think that success leads to happiness when it's actually the other way around. Yeah. So I think we have to reach a point of contentment and happiness in our lives first, and then I think success is a byproduct of that. Yeah. Otherwise you're always just gonna be, you know, chasing your own tail. Yeah. Or like reaching for the next thing, you'll just never be happy. Yeah.
Well, on that note, thanks for your time.
No worries, thanks for having me.
It's a bit illuminating for me, so it's been great.
Oh, likewise. I hope this has been somewhat coherent. If not, you have a lot of editing to do.
I have to admit, when I first sat down with Charlie, I did not think that we would end up talking about the secret to happiness. Charlie was so thoughtful about his achievements, and I particularly enjoyed the bit in which he talked about avoiding tropes of success. This is a man who, above all else, loves the process of making music, and it comes through so clearly in his writing. And I can't wait to see what new music Charlie will continue to release. I thought he pulled off a masterstroke with the evolution of his sound from Time and Space to Check Hook, so I'm really excited to see where he goes from here. Thank you again for your time, Charlie. I learned so much from our conversation.
Now, if you like what you're hearing, then please subscribe to the podcast. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and your favorite podcast apps. And get in touch on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram using the handle @boldbutgoldsg or visit boldbutgoldsg.com. We'll be back again real soon with another episode about Singaporeans who are doing things their own way. I'll see you again real soon.